Good afternoon, everybody. I want to welcome you to the House Judiciary Committee this afternoon. We're actually 4 minutes ahead of our traditional 12-minute start after the hour start time, so I want to congratulate the committee. Our average is improving. Note that Representative McPherson just walked in. We're going to go ahead and start with the one bill that Mr. Prinz has under his jurisdiction, House Bill 2069. And I will open a work session on that bill. Council.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. This House Bill 2069 comes to you from the Defense Attorneys, Defense Lawyers Association. We heard the testimony on this back in January. The only testimony we heard was from Susan Russell, who's not here, but Kelly Skye is here. We did not hear any testimony in opposition, and I have never heard any testimony in opposition. Ms. Skye actually told me today that this was a concept that the Department of Justice talked with the defense attorneys about. What this bill does is it sets the time frames for making a motion for a new trial or a motion to arrest a judgment, which means to not enter a judgment, from 5 days to 10 days. And the reason we would be doing that would be so that this would no longer be an exception to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, that ORCP 64 would apply, so that we don't have a situation where we have one exception to those timing rules that foul up practitioners when there's really no policy reason for that exception.
All right, are there questions for Council Prinz? So no amendments, right, Craig?
No amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Przanski.
If you're ready for a motion, I'll make a motion to send House Bill 2069 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2069 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, hearing none. Call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Trumbull?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Kozomski?
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Oops.
Two twins.
It was two votes.
Violating the rule.
Aye.
Get a little aye. Myself. House Bill 2069 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Craig. Volunteer carrier? Okay.
I'll take it.
You want to take it,
yeah.
Mom? All right, Representative Ackerman. Okay, next we'll open a work session on House Bill 2073. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the dash two amendments in front of you with this bill. The amendments replace the bill. It creates the state court facilities task force is created, appointments by president, the Speaker of the House, the Chief Justice, Association of Oregon Counties, the Board of Governors. Wrong association. The state court facilities task force shall study and make recommendations relating to what suitable and sufficient is as far as court facilities, and report back to the next legislative session. Over on page 4, you will notice it also increases the unitary assessment as it relates to traffic infractions. And on page 4, line 11, it deletes 35 and leaves a blank there. This is basically the base fine amount when you get a traffic fine. And it's for the purposes of funding this study. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Okay.
Dennis Mulvihill, Bob Olson, and Paul Snyder are here. They have worked on the amendments, and I understand they have come to a mutual agreement on the amendments.
And I see Brad Swing from the courts as well. So do all of you want to come forward just briefly? And you really don't have to even organize yourselves too closely on how you're sitting, because I'm just going to ask you one general question. Does this amendment reflect the consensus agreement among the groups that are sitting at the table?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Brad?
We have no problem with these amendments.
Paul?
Chair.
Oh,
yes.
Mr. Chair, they're okay.
Not real strong, Paul.
They're good, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So AOC is happy with these amendments?
AOC, yeah.
All right. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Question hasn't been asked whether they're happy with the bill as amended.
You're free to ask it, Representative.
I am. If these amendments are adopted, are you happy with the bill?
Mr. Chair, the same answer.
Same answer?
Representative Jensen, yes.
Colleagues, you'll remember the discussion on this. This has been an ongoing discussion to try to figure out how to at least begin the conversation about what, thank you, gentlemen, about what we're going to do about court facilities. This bill has a Ways and Means subsequent referral, so they're going to be the final deciders of whether or not this bill moves forward or not. I think it's imperative that at some point we start to have a process by which we're going to evaluate how we're going to deal with the decaying nature of courthouses in this state as they become in and of themselves an impediment to people getting the justice that the system that we have requires. So my recommendation is to adopt the amendments, move the bill to Ways and Means. Obviously, it'll be a challenge as it fits into the mix of all the other things they're doing down there. But hopefully the chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee will be sufficiently deposed to move the bill forward. Yes, Representative Jensen.
I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2073.
Representative Jensen moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2073. Is there a discussion on the motion? Any objection? The amendments are adopted.
Chair.
Representative Jensen?
I move the House Bill 2073 to the Committee on Ways and Means with due pass as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. He moves that House Bill 2073 as amended be moved to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pazonski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2073 goes to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass. Thank you. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2440, or excuse me, a work session on House Bill 2440. They're not here? Okay. It's been brought to my attention, and I was going to give them an opportunity to say something here, but it's been brought to my attention that House Bill 2414 does not have sufficient support within the committee to be referred to the floor. So I'm not going to bother to take our time to go into work session. So we're just going to skip over that bill. So I'm going to now open a work session on House Bill 2725. Council.
Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2725 modifies the crime of giving false information to police officers, including service of warrants. You have the -1 amendments. This bill comes to you from Representative Przanski. The -1 amendments basically, they're technical in nature. For example, they delete warrant and insert an arrest warrant. Line 9, they delete serving a warrant, insert for the purposes of officers arresting the person on an arrest warrant, and delete the comma, insert, or, and delete. They're technical, Mr. Chairman, as a claim, but I'm sure Representative Przanski can.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, if you remember when this bill was before us on public hearing, there are some concerns as to how broad it could be interpreted and what it actually applied to. The intent of myself in bringing the bill forward was to limit it to situations where you have an individual giving a false name at the time that the officer is attempting to serve or arrest an individual on a outstanding warrant. So the -1s hopefully will in fact take care of the issues. As counsel has said on page, on line 6, we are going to be inserting the N with the A and then inserting the word arrest, so it would read on line 6 after the or an arrest warrant. And then when you drop down to line 9, we're deleting the first three words, which is serving a warrant, and instead will be for the purpose of the officers arresting the person on an arrest warrant. And then the other modification, based on the catch from Representative Shutterly, we're taking out the last of the three ORS sites which dealt with search warrants, and it will be limited to the first two, which is 133.110 or 133.120, period. The other thing I guess I wanted to just put on the record, when we had this discussion, there's some, I guess, I know the OCDLA had some issues as to how this could be applied, and it really is my intent in bringing this bill forward to punish those individuals who give a police officer a false name when the officer has basically made it clear when he has made his intentions known that he was requesting the name for the purpose of serving a warrant. That's, I guess, my caveat disclaimer. I know that OCDLA may still have some problems as to whether there could be a constitutional challenge for someone during the point of having just mere conversation when the officer just first starts talking to them as to whether they have some duty to give a true name, let alone any name, when an officer is like conducting a traffic stop and there's a passenger in the vehicle. So that's for the record.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, at this time, I would move the dash ones into House Bill 2725.
Representative Przanski's moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2725. Is there discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To a non-court-oriented person, it seems strange that we shouldn't expect that people would be telling the truth from the get-go, but I understand the vagaries of life today. Just any way we can encourage or enhance the public safety officials to be able to get good ID from people the first time out seems like a good idea to me.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, so the motion is to adopt the dash one amendments. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? The dash ones are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll now move House Bill 2725 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2725 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, hearing none, Ann, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Pierson?
Excuse.
Representative Przanski?
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye.
House
Bill 2725 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Przanski to carry. Open a work session on House Bill 2729.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2729 comes to you from Representative Przanski. It allows a victim in a criminal matter to have his or her name and address not placed on a judgment order. The defendant pays the victim restitution. The defendant pays the victim restitution or compensatory fine. We have the dash one amendments in front of you. They go, once again, they're pretty technical in nature. They delete the words remain confidential and insert be exempt from disclosure in a public record on page 2, and line 16, and page 4, line 3.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Przanski.
I'll go ahead and just move the dash ones into House Bill 2729 before discussion.
All right, Representative Przanski has moved the dash one amendments into House Bill 2729. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair, just for everyone's clarification, if you remember, this was a bill dealing with victims and the concern that their identification could become public because it's required to be placed on a judgment. We heard from the court staff as to the concern that you have to have a judgment creditor, i.e. the victim, or someone's name listed there to make that occur. So in speaking with Lane County District Attorney's Office, we decided that what we would ask is to just have that information exempt from public record. Currently, the courts do, in fact, exempt various pieces of information that is in a court file or record from the public record. One would be as it pertains to a defendant's financial status. When they have to fill out for an indigent defense, there's a lot of monetary information they have to provide to the court. That information is exempt from public disclosure, and the only people, my understanding, that can see that information is the court or the attorney of record for the individual. So we felt that this would be a means to address the concerns of the court and at the same time maintain the safety and security of the victim.
Okay, are there questions for the representative about the Dash 1 amendments to 2729? Floyd, can you just recap for us, what was our original concern with the bill? I mean, there was...
Brad Swank came in, and his concern was that the judgment needed to have someone's name on there as the creditor or an address so there could actually be entered a judgment reflecting that the individual was to be receiving the restitution from the judgment debtor, who would be the defendant in these cases. What we had attempted, or what we first thought we could do, is just basically not require that line to be furnished in the actual judgment. But his concern was that without it, you never had a valid judgment against the defendant and the recipient of those of the money being identified by the court. We thought at one point that maybe a way of dealing with this was to allow the individual to, if they didn't want to use a friend, family, or other address, that they could use the district attorney's office. But after a quick conversation with Lane County DA's office, they made it very clear that this would be a burden that would be very unduly on all district attorney's offices, and they felt that that should not be a, and would be very hard for them to actually to comply with without maybe additional research and staff. Resources and staff to process those type of requests. In that discussion, we reviewed what is currently in a court file in a prosecution, and it was brought to my attention and reminded me that there is already information that is not open for public disclosure, and so we felt just a public or an exemption from the public record would suffice and still maintain the information for the court for its use, but not for public disclosure.
Okay. Are there any other questions? The motion is to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. And did this satisfy the court's concerns?
As far as I know, it did. Brad knew that I was working on amendments. I have not heard back from him, and he did catch up with me on another bill, so I assume I did not actually run this past him. If it's a problem, I assume we can deal with it on the Senate side.
Okay.
Just... Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, you want to get your mic?
Just out of interest, how do these type of laws fit up against the Federal Privacy Act or the ability to get information on most everything? Is there any correlation?
Well, most information in a court file, most information in a court file is public record.
Right.
And so what this would be doing is it would be exempting it from disclosure upon a public record request, or if someone's attempting to access the court file through physical means by going to the courthouse or pulling up something on the computer on the OGIN system. And those public terminals are available in the courthouse. But again, traditionally, there has been the sense that from an earlier statute, which we're now amending to try to deal with this problem, that the victim's information on a restitution judgment would not be openly available. So, you know, the person who victimized the victim in the first instance wouldn't be given the information necessarily on how to find the victim again. I mean, that's obviously one of the concerns. Is that about right, Floyd?
It is.
Yeah. Okay, so the motion is to adopt the Dash 1s. Representative Ackerman.
I just wanted to follow up on that. I think what is a little confusing is there's, when we're exempting matters from public scrutiny, that we're not amending the Public Records Act that contains those provisions. So it's sort of hanging out there. It should maybe be cross-referenced. Maybe that's something the Senate can deal with. But
that's
the intent is there.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's sort of the one that Representative Shetterly raised the other day on another public records law. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and is there any objection to the motion to adopt the dash one? Hearing none, the dash ones have been adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2729 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Prozanski moves House Bill 2729 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Okay, hearing none, Ann, go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Prozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2729 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It's another one of your bills, Representative. Do you want to carry it?
I'll take it.
Okay. Going to open a work session now on House Bill 2733.
Council. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2733 comes to you from Representative Prozanski, and I think we all well remember this bill because we now have the dash two amendments before us. This reorganizes provisions relating to venue and violations cases. In other words, which county can you?
Oh yeah.
Can you bring the venue?
This is the three strikes or you're out. Boy.
This is it. This is it. And this is the up to bat. That's 3-2 on the. On the batter, and we're in the bottom of the ninth.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what it does is basically deletes lines 13 through 17 of the bill and substitutes it with the language and you see in front of you. If a violation proceedings is commenced in a county other than the county in which the violation was committed, the proceedings may be commenced, A, in the circuit court, notwithstanding the provisions of ORS 51050 that limit the jurisdiction of justice courts to offenses committed within that county in a justice court, or if the violation was committed within the city in the municipal court of the city. And then further down, it adds the defendant may not request that the place of trial be changed if the violation was committed within the city and the proceedings is commenced within the municipal court of the city.
Mr. Chair, if I could elaborate.
Yeah, please do.
On the dash twos, we do in fact take care of the issues that were raised at the committee level regarding when a violation was being commenced in a county other than the county in which the violation occurred. We've set up, as counsel said, three places that it can go. First, it can go to the circuit court. Second, it can go to the justice court. And third, if the violation was committed within the city, it can be cited into the municipal court. If you remember, Representative Shetterly also raised the concern at that point because when we look at Salem, West Salem is in Polk County, and you could, in fact, potentially have an individual that at that point would have been prohibited from being cited into the Salem Municipal Court. This will provide that he or she can, in fact, be cited into that municipal court. Lastly, on lines 14 through 16 of the amendment, we're also placing in there that once a person's been cited into the municipal court, such as Salem, if that is a proper venue, meaning that the incident actually occurred within the city, it would stay there. That way, the city would not be out going would need to send their officers to Polk County to actually try a case that originated in the municipal court and had the jurisdiction and venue properly cited into that court. So I think it actually catches what might have been the third strike, and I would have been out before we got there.
All right. Are there questions for Representative Prozanski about the amendment? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, on page, line 5 of the dash 2s, when you say in a circuit court, you don't identify which circuit court you mean when the violation is commenced in one county and committed in another.
That's correct. It basically, we're maintaining the language that was originally on what would be on line 14 of the bill, which says the proceeding may commence in a circuit court, and then it went through and gave two other courts that it could go into, the justice court or under the current provisions into a municipal court that was adjacent or in a county that was adjacent to where the offense occurred. So, yes, we're not designating which court. It's based on my understanding is the way that these have worked is that it has been based on proximity to the location of the offense. So it's more for convenience.
Representative Shetterly.
Yeah, I think we're covered there because the language in lines, 5 through 9 of the bill are still in, and that refers either to the county in which the violation was committed or another county whose county seat is shorter by distance, shorter distance by road from where the violation occurred. And so I think you put that together, and that's going to limit which circuit court you can refer the violation to.
Right.
Okay. Anybody else? Have you moved the dash twos, Floyd?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash twos in the House Bill 2733.
Representative Brzezinski's moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 2733. Is there further discussion? Any objection? The dash twos are in the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I now move House Bill 2733 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 2733 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay. And call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pozovsky?
Aye.
Representative Cheverly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Votes aye. House Bill 2733 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Brzezinski?
Yes, sir.
This is.
I would not wish this on anyone.
This is Representative Brzezinski Day here in the Judiciary Committee. For those of you who don't know, you get a free pennant and a funny hat on your way out. Okay.
And a free bike ride, too.
Yeah. Next, we're going to go ahead and we're going to skip 2803 for the time being. We'll come back to it at the end. And I'm going to do 2865. Open up. Work session on House Bill 2865.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2865 does basically three things. Allows the district attorney to treat certain felonies as Class A misdemeanors, allows information in an official police report to be presented to a grand jury by a peace officer other than the officer who made the report, provides a defendant who refuses to provide true name may not be released except upon payment of full security amount. We have the dash one amendments in front of you. These amendments were prepared by Mr. Bradley, who originally introduced the bill through the Judiciary Committee, and I'm sure he'd be more than willing to fill you in the details.
Okay.
I've gone through them, and they seem to be what we talked about the last
All right. Time. Why don't we have Mr. Bradley come up, and you've got someone there in tow with you.
Well,
yeah, come on up, sir.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I guess I divide this bill up into three parts. The first is the district attorney being able to treat certain felonies as misdemeanors. The second is the grand jury and the state being allowed to use police reports in the grand jury rather than live witness. And the third is requiring the defendants to provide their true name at the time of arraignment. I think it's fair to say that on the first and third matters, I've talked to Susan Russell today, and she said that the OCDLA doesn't have any opposition to the bills as amended. They would still ask that the grand jury section be amended. But with that, I'll go through what the amendments are. The First Amendment, I brought this up last time on line 7, saying that the district attorney can do this only on non-person felonies. That was at the request of Mr. Dole, who felt that, really, that person felony should not be subject to that. And for the most part, I tend to agree with that. On line 9, it says the district attorney can do this orally or in writing. And again, or in writing, that was Mr. Harkleroad's suggestion. It was something I just left out. I think it's something that we would print on the indictment or on the information. And I sort of think that's it on that first section. Are there any questions about that?
Anything on those first two points?
Okay. Then the final section would be, I call it the third section. I guess it starts with section number 4. And what this says is it just says that when a defendant gets up, they have to give their true name. And there's a definition of true name, and one of the things is Representative Shetterly last time said, what if somebody did not have a birth certificate? So we sat down and tried to figure out, there are a number of people we do see in the court that they do not have birth certificates, and they never had them. This doesn't mean you have to show your birth certificate. It just merely means, did you ever have one? And in those cases, what this does is it provides a section for saying the person under oath would say what their birth name was or what their legal name was. And the other thing, the other changes it makes is that Susan Russell was concerned that Section 7 would go back and capture everybody who in the past given false names. And I said that was not our intent. I said we don't have the time to do that. That this law would, and I wanted to make sure it was clear, would only apply to that conduct on or after the effective day of the law. Does that make sense? And those are the amendments that were offered.
Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I thought another one that had been discussed was under, I guess, what would be the second section or the part two, that the hearsay evidence was going to be limited to chain of custody.
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, I think you had mentioned it. Susan Russell asked us about that, and I brought Mr. French here to discuss why we didn't do that.
Bill?
That's why you're here.
Yeah, I'm Deputy District Attorney Chuck French, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. When we drafted this initially, again, as I think I may have said before, this was one of the measures that we took a look at based on cost-saving analysis, both for our office, for the police departments around the state, and for the court administration, the state budgetary issues. We have three grand juries in Multnomah County. Each of them are, my guess is they're spent about, we're spending $4,000 a piece on those at $12,000 a month. Okay. What's that? Maybe $140,000 a year for grand juries. Oregon is one of the states that is peculiar in that initiation of criminal procedures requires either a grand jury or a preliminary hearing. Many states like Washington don't require that. And we're going through this process. We took a look at it simply. We go through this grand jury process. We've taken a look at it simply from a matter of cost-cutting standards, and we concluded that many other states don't require hearsay evidence. The federal government, or don't exclude hearsay evidence. The federal government allows the use of all hearsay evidence in grand juries. And we didn't think that was necessarily appropriate, but we wanted to come to some middle ground that would allow us to retain legal integrity and save as much money as possible. And this is sort of what we came to, that a police officer could testify about what is in the official reports of another sworn officer. We didn't think it appropriate that unsworn individuals, citizens, be allowed, their testimony be allowed to be heard in that manner. And so we did want to sort of discuss with the committee and discuss with our opponents here whether or not it's appropriate to go beyond just merely chain of custody evidence, which is what I believe Representative Brzezinski was talking about the last time we were here. And we just wanted to throw it open so we could discuss whether in meeting sort of halfway between the standards of the federal government and the standards that now exist in Oregon, if we could save some money and meet us halfway between those, if that would be a good thing. We think it would be a good thing if we are permitted to put testimony in the grand jury from sworn police officers, only sworn police officers, through other police officers. We find that we have many cases where three or four police officers come in to testify, and that oftentimes two or three of those officers, their testimony is simply about either chain of custody matters or possession of a defendant, or simply a crime scene, all of which, where a lamppost was located, where the car was located. And those are all things which could very easily be done by one police officer based on official reports filed by that other officer. So we feel it's an appropriate thing to put into a bill. Obviously, I think there's a agreement from all sides that simple chain of custody evidence should come, should be able to come in under hearsay exception. But we feel that if we go a little bit beyond that, we still retain the legal integrity of the grand jury process, and even that doesn't go as far as what many other states go to, and it will save, for instance, the Portland Police Bureau hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to do that. Could conceivably save the state hundreds of thousands, or maybe across the state, millions of dollars in setting up grand juries and paying for the fees of grand jurors to come in and testify at, I think it's $25 a day now, or come in and hear testimony at $25 a day. It all adds up. That's why we'd like at least a discussion on the bill as it was originally submitted.
Chair Williams, if I could say one other thing.
You may.
Two other
Bradley.
Things. One thing that this will promote is it would promote better police reports by police officers, because if they know that these are things that if their departments require other officers to be specific, these things are going to be in reports, and we're currently they're not. The other thing is, I can't say if it was 1981 or 1983 when the new evidence code was new then. The evidence code became the law in the state of Oregon, but prior to that time, even though there was no clear law on it, there was no prohibition of using hearsay in the grand jury, and it was 81 or 83 when we adopted the evidence code that the requirement, the rule became is that you could only use competent evidence in the grand jury.
Okay, further questions for these gentlemen? Representative Brzezinski.
Not questions, just I guess maybe debate. I don't know if you want to do that now or.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you have a question for him, you can question him. Because we've allowed them to talk about the amendment, I'm going to ask Ms. Skye to come up and give up the DLA's comments on it as well.
Let me ask Mr. French, under your scenario, because in my scenarios where I represent the city of Florence, we have officers who are required to go into Lane County. The way I read this, it's broad enough that I could have an officer involved in a case or multiple officers involved in the case, and none of them would be required to show up in Eugene and grand jury, that they could actually just fax their police reports to the district attorney's office, and then another sworn police officer who may not have been involved in that case could, in fact, go in and testify on their behalf. You could actually have the county deputies coming in to grand jury presenting cases that are not their cases under the broadness of this, and I do have some concerns with that. I can understand and accept at some level that one Florence police officer may be able to go over or should be able to go over and do that, but I don't see that limitation as to being officers that are involved. The other part, I guess, is that the Oregon Constitution versus the federal Constitution is as to the safeguards that we may have interpreted by our courts to being stricter than what the federal courts might allow in the way of general use of hearsay in a grand jury.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, members of the committee, my response to that is, I think that's a good idea, and when we initially started kicking it around, we thought that it would be appropriate to put in that an officer, not just in the same police force, but an officer involved in the same investigation could testify about facts in the police report of another officer involved in that investigation. And the fact scenario would be search warrant in a house, for instance, where drugs are found. The police officer who's in charge of that investigation could then testify about what the other officers under him had, the reports the other officers had filed. That's typically, procedurally, what the federal government does. I think that's a good idea, and what you're envisioning is, well, if someone, we just have a, what we could do under the current way it's written, if you have a problem with that, might be that an officer, we just have one officer on call all the time to read police reports to the grand jury, and I think that it would be appropriate to amend it to include that. That was our original thought on that, to do it that way so that not just an officer from the same agency, but an officer involved in the same investigation. And I think there was initially that was the wording of it. When it left my desk, it got changed a couple times. But I think that would be inappropriate if it's causing you concern, and I can see why it would. I think it would be an appropriate amendment there. As far as the state constitution versus the federal constitution, I don't think there, maybe Ms. Guy could disagree with me, but I don't think there's anything in the state constitution as far as the constitution of grand juries are concerned that applies to the evidence code. The evidence code is what controls the admissibility of evidence in any proceeding, and the state statutes as far as the grand jury are, control that as far as the grand jury, and I guess this would be an amendment to the evidence that's admissible in grand jury proceedings, if that answers your question.
Thanks. Yes, Representative Parker.
I just make a comment, if I may, Mr. Chairman, on the amount of money that Mr. French said it could save. In the last, my last job, well, in fact, the last over 20 years that I worked, I signed overtime slips, and I can assure you that we spend a ton of money for somebody to go in and say, yes, I advise him of his rights. That officer gets 6 hours pay for saying that and walking back out the door. And then the next officer says, yeah, and I picked up the piece and I gave it to Bob, and then Bob has to say he gave it to me and I can put it in the evidence room. And those kind of things are very, very expensive, but that's just the way, under the code, the way it is now, those officers had to do that. And with the contract, at least in Portland, where they're allowed a four-hour minimum at time and a half, and that's for the night shifts, it was just astronomical the amount of money that was spent on that kind of thing. And even officers could manipulate that by saying, I'll advise him of his rights so I can get called to the grand jury with you. And so I think this would help a lot. Would save the city. I know it would save the city of Portland a ton of money.
Who was representing those police union guys?
Will Aitchison. Will Aitchison. Lawyer extraordinaire.
I was going to say Portland got,
wow,
got better callback than Eugene had.
Thank you, gentlemen. Ms. Skye.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And Mr. Bradley is correct. We do support the first section of the bill. Certainly, we would allow any of the felonies to be treated as misdemeanors. We are taking no position on the third portion of the bill as amended, dealing with true name, as the amendments will make it, it won't be allowable to use the false name or the use of the false name and correct to a true name in any other criminal proceeding, including fugitive matters. As to the grand jury portion, we still do strongly oppose that portion. Just to remind you, grand jury, the standard of proof there is probable cause. So they're not proving the case to the grand jury beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's not necessary to bring an officer in to testify, yes, I advised him of his rights, because the grand jury is not looking at constitutional issues of whether statements were obtained legally or not. If an officer's testimony is required in order to meet that low standard of proof, probable cause, then the grand jury needs to hear that testimony from that officer. I'm glad that Representative Przanski brought up our other concern, which is we could have an officer of the day sitting there reading police reports to the grand jury, and clearly everybody agrees that that's inappropriate. Overall, it's really important that we not disassemble our criminal justice system in a time of budget crisis just to save money, because this is the first budget crisis, and if we can't keep the criminal justice system and the constitutional protections for criminal defendants in place now, they will only erode as the budget gets worse. Further, it's very important that we don't erode a defendant's constitutional rights in order to protect from abuses in other parts of the system. And it's unfortunate that there are officers who want to get paid the overtime to come in and testify in front of the grand jury, but that's not a reason to change a defendant's statutory rights to have their case presented to a grand jury. And it's bad public policy to come in the back door and take away one person's rights because somebody else is abusing the system. The evidence code defines what competent evidence is, and only competent evidence can be brought before the grand jury. And while the evidence code is statutory in nature, it's based on the constitutional principle of fundamental fairness. And so When we start to allow non-competent evidence before a grand jury, you may also not be saving money, because part of what a grand jury does is screen out cases, and if a grand jury hears evidence that could not be presented at trial and based on that evidence issues an indictment, then you have a case in the system, you have attorneys appointed, you have a trial based on evidence that couldn't have been presented at trial. And those are the reasons why we have this statute, is to require competent evidence before the grand jury. It will limit the number of cases that are issued. We would not oppose the amendments that were discussed before, and that is to allow for chain of custody, and certainly in situations where a search warrant is served. We don't intend to oppose one officer coming in and saying, these are the items that were found by all of the officers. They were brought to me, and we do not need every officer to come in and testify to chain of custody, but we do oppose the bill as it is written.
There are questions for Ms. Skye. Yes, Representative.
I guess I just want to follow up based on my discussions with Mr. French and Mr. Bradley. If this was limited to chain of custody issues, and if they had the requirement, well, first of all, if it was just for chain of custody, would you have an objection to that portion of the bill?
No.
Second question would be, if we agreed that an officer from the same investigation could in fact present the case, since it is only probable on preponderance of evidence to the grand jury, do you still have a problem with an officer that's actually involved in the case, that knows the investigation, being able to represent to the jury what occurred, what they had, I would assume, direct knowledge of based on their involvement in the case, as compared to the professional witness for law enforcement on that particular day in grand jury?
We would still oppose that. And certainly an officer now can testify to anything that they have direct knowledge of. If they overhear a defendant say something to another officer, just because that statement is in that other officer's report, they can testify to that now. So anything that they're allowed to do all of that now. We would oppose them being able to read off of another officer's report or to summarize what another officer told them. And there is, you know, we have concerns about an officer going in and basically summarizing the case on behalf of all the officers who investigated it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Skye. Well, we've heard both positions well-placed and stated before the committee. We have
conceptual amendments?
Well, I don't think we want to do conceptual amendments. I'm not sure that gets us anywhere. Is there a motion on the dash ones?
Move to accept it, or move to include the dash ones.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2865. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Based on the motion being made, I will be opposing the motion at this point based on the broad language under what looks like subsection 7 of section 3 on page 2, beginning on lines 22 and ending on 27, which appears that would allow any police officer in this state to be able to testify to any other police officer's report, even though the one giving the testimony may have no direct knowledge or involvement in the case as being presented to the grand jury.
Okay. Your objection is noted. We'll go ahead and call the roll. Anybody else? Representative Jensen?
I would object to on the same principle.
Okay. And you want to call the roll on the adoption of the dash ones?
Okay. Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Kozanski?
No.
Representative Cheddarly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
No.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. The dash ones are in. Well, now, isn't this a pretty picture?
Some on the dark side, so.
Yeah.
Well, I know. I'm just sort of sort of smiling. Here's what I'm going to recommend, because I suspect if we take this bill to a vote, it may not get as strong a support on its vote as it got in the adoption of the amendments. So the chair is going to close the work session on this bill and suggest that the proponents of the bill consider some modification to that grand jury amendment. Work session closed.
Good.
Going to open a work session on House Bill 2877. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2877 allows the district attorney to make a resolution offer to offenders before arraignment. At the last meeting, we had a question raised by one of the witnesses concerning the constitutionality of this particular provision. And you have before you, finally, the full version of Legislative Council's opinion dated April 9, 2003, to you, basically saying that House Bill 2877, in their opinion, is constitutional on its face.
Okay. Everybody remember this bill?
Mm-hmm.
And there are no amendments, are there, Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are no amendments to the bill.
Okay. The issue was constitutionality that was raised, and I think if you look closely at the Legislative Council opinion, which I requested, what it says is that there is nothing that's unconstitutional so long as that the defendant is apprised of their right to counsel and can waive the right to counsel and waive it if it is voluntary, knowing, and intelligent, and that that's likely going to be a case-by-case determination, something the judge will likely go through at the time that the disposition is put before the court. So that's the status on the constitutional issue that with those questions raised. So ultimately, I think if you look at that opinion, the answer is, can it be unconstitutional? The answer is yes, in a set of circumstances in which the waiver of the right to counsel was not voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. But the program itself and the access to the program for these early disposition not assigning counsel at the time is not in and of itself unconstitutional. So that's the issue. Comments? Discussion? Representative Anderson.
Well, I was going to move the bill to the floor.
Well, you can do that.
I'd like to move House Bill.
Would probably exercise the discussion a bit more.
Yeah.
Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2877.
To the floor with a due pass.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I am troubled. I guess the question of constitutionality is one and policy is another. I think we heard some testimony that I thought was compelling from, was it Kelly Skye last time we heard this? About the myriad defenses, sometimes technical defenses and search and seizure issues, of which a person likely is just not going to be sophisticated enough to know on their own, and putting them in a position of having to choose between the deal today or not without being apprised of defenses that may be available to them statutorily and even constitutionally. I understand the expediency of it, and I understand the budget implications of it, and I'm sensitive to that. But I'm also concerned about the balance between the hand of government and the hand of individual rights when faced with the weight of criminal prosecution. And I don't know. This one just I'm going to have some problems with this. I think on account of that.
Okay, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've seen a lot of minor thieves and so on that would like to get things resolved quickly, and they'd be willing to take this offer. If they ask for a lawyer, they can have one, and they have to knowingly make the waiver, so that'll have to be something included from the DA's office to do that. And not only because it's a tight budget, and I've had this discussion with people who are opposed to not only this bill but others, saying just because we're in budget troubles, we should not shortchange the system or based on that. And I have to agree with that, but we ought to look for savings even if we had a fat budget, which we don't. And I think this would provide a way to move things through quickly. We wouldn't have to appoint a defense attorney for somebody who just wants to plead guilty, get caught shoplifting, and G.I. Joes, they're ready to get it resolved. These are cases that are not including jail time, as I understand it. They're going to offer, they'll make him an offer. Here's what we want you to do. Then the people can say no, even when they make the offer to him. They can say no, even after they've been advised. So I think this is a good opportunity to keep things flowing down there in the lower levels of the court. And I understand also the argument about, even though this is nothing, it might compound on them later when they get convicted of something else. I say so be it. I just think this, I don't think this is will deprive anybody of any great constitutional protections. I think they'll have those. And I'd like to see it go forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, and when the bill came before us before, I don't know if I said this on the record to Mr. Bradley or outside, I question whether this bill even needs to be here, House Bill 2877. I can only tell you that in my practice as a municipal court prosecutor, we actually make offers to individuals on the day of their arraignment with a packet basically saying this is what we're willing to offer if you're willing to take care of the matter on that day in question. And, of course, they are told beforehand that they, one, have no requirement to even speak to us, to take an offer from us if they choose not to, that they have the right, and that the court will tell them that they have a right to an attorney, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see, I guess, really the need for the bill in the first place. I think this is putting an extra step in a process that's not necessary, except for maybe in my review of what is term the early disposition programs that have been established under some criteria, which maybe they are giving this stuff out to them before arraignment. But on the day of arraignment, I deal with every individual that comes in, either with or without an attorney, as they stand on their own, because at that point in time they are representing themselves. And until they tell me, one, they don't want to speak with me after being told they have no duty to do so, and two, having the court tell them that they are going to be making the decision for themselves today, or they can be seeking an attorney to represent them either through the court or on their own, I see everyone as being equal. So I'm not sure if it's necessary for this bill to even be enacted to give the district attorney or the assistant district attorneys the ability to make resolutions prior to the arraignment. And I'm not sure if this is being done on a day separate from their arraignment date or on the day of arraignment.
Does that mean you're a no?
let's say I'm leaning that way.
All right. Representative Ackerman?
Yes. On the counsel issue, I think there's two protections here. There's one in the bill at line 11 where there will be a process to ensure the availability of legal representation. And I think that the second one is as applied. When these disposition agreements are approved by the court, I'm assuming there's a complaint already in the file naming the defendant, and the early disposition would be something other than a plea of guilty. However, the defendant would be before the court without counsel, and in that situation, the court has a defined and specific obligation to make sure that the waiver of counsel is constitutionally correct. So I think with those safeguards, I feel that is probably a good bill as drafted and as applied to protect the right of counsel issue.
Okay, thank you. Well, we've had a helpful and useful discussion. Now I'm going to ask Ann to call the roll.
Constitutional Law Day. Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Przanski?
No.
Representative Shetterly?
No.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye.
House Bill 2877 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman, would you carry?
I will.
Okay.
Thank you.
That leaves us now to House Bill 2803, and I'll open a work session on that bill. Council is going to be distributing to you copies of a Dash 4 amendment. The Dash 4 amendment eliminates the words private prison from the bill. Substitutes the words Shiloh in.
Is this still hot off the press?
It probably needs the business.
No, the Dash 4 amendments, colleagues, as you look at it, says it's the same as the Dash 3. It simply says that as you evaluate the availability and cost of correctional facilities in this state, considering constitutional requirements, state law requirements, and the availability of programs that enhance the likelihood of offenders successful functioning in society upon release, and determines that the appropriate correctional facilities are not available to the state. Compare it to the Dash 3 and you'll see how it's different.
Oh, okay. Seems to drop the preference provision in section 2.2.
Who's bringing us the Dash 4?
The Dash 4s are a alternative amendment which I requested that be drafted.
Oh, okay.
When I determined that it was a good chance that the Dash 3s might not be successful.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Can you point out to me why the Dash 4s are to be interpreted that private correction facilities are not?
Isn't that what the Dash 4s do, Claudia? Do you want to come up and explain that or send Mitch up?
Thank you, Rick.
This is the first time I've seen them, but it was my understanding that the Dash 4s were to remove the offending concern about the inclusion of private prisons. Is that right, Claudia?
Claudia Black, Department of Corrections. That is my understanding as well. Person was the term that we were using to indicate a private entity, and we had person or public entity. And by taking out the word person and only having public entity, then we no longer would have the ability to rent out-of-state beds in private facilities.
Right. So basically, it's at the very top of the bill then. In line 4 of the printed bill,
correct,
delete the word person and insert public entity. And if you notice in the Dash 3s, it says after person, insert, or public entity. So essentially the word person comes out, and it's only public entities which can be ordered in preference. Everybody? Yes, Representative.
Well, yeah, I see that. It's interesting, actually, in that sense, the Dash 3s probably don't make sense, because if you define out the Dash 3s making the change from person to public entity, I'm not sure that you get to line 19 and 21 in the Dash 3s anyway, because it only authorizes contracts with public entities. So I don't know if you need a preference in the Dash 3s for contracts with public entities, because that's all that's authorized anyway. So the Dash 4s do make sense.
Well, no, in the Dash 3s it says person or public entity.
Oh, it's or. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
It's or public entity.
Okay.
And
right.
You want to delete.
Right. So
okay. I see.
So the preference language comes out, but it's only public entity that's included, so therefore it can't be with a private institution.
Got it.
Everybody tracking?
So, yes.
Okay. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, can we just have Ms. Black go through the order of how this is going to be done? Because I remember we're going to look at what facilities we have currently in the state, I think one being current corrections facilities, and then we're looking at what, if you can just walk us through that so we'll have it for the record.
I'm going to ask Mitch Morrow, Assistant Director for Institutions, to address that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it'll start with our facilities, then move to our emergency beds, then we'll look at county facilities, and then out of state.
OYA.
OYA has been evaluated. We're trying to get the costs associated with that. But yeah, there's two facilities we're looking at in regards to OYA as well.
And then when we say outside the state, would be, again, limited just to public entity, so prisons, correction facilities that ran by the state, whatever that state may be.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
And are you also looking at lower levels of correction facilities, such as counties out of state, or would this be limited to state correction facilities for out of state?
Mr. Chair,
prisons?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative, we haven't looked at the county option out of state. We've basically in the past, and probably we'll continue to look at public institutions, state prison type settings.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, I thought in Denton County, which is outside of Dallas, I thought the facility they were in was actually a Denton County jail facility. Or am I mistaken? Was that a private facility or one of the TDC, Texas Department of Corrections facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was a private facility.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you, Claudia. Thank you, Mitch. Chair would move the adoption of the -4 amendments to House Bill 2803. Is there any further discussion?
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
In a time when we really are looking for economies of any scale we can get, I think we're making a mistake to take the private side out. I understand the problems that have occurred in the past with jail prisoners being able to escape. We've had that happen on the public side as well in both county and state facilities. So I think this is kind of a discrimination against the private side that we shouldn't be considering.
Okay. Anything else?
If I may.
Representative Barker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just feel that if these were private facilities in the state of Oregon, I might feel more comfortable having them in. But I'm really concerned with I don't know what they do in those in other places, and it would be we only sent a few people. We wouldn't have a state monitor there, and so I would not support private.
Okay.
I'm glad that they're – I mean, I support the major – or -4.
Okay, so the motion is to adopt the -4s. Do you want to be noted as a no, Representative Anderson? So Representative Anderson is a no. Is there any other no votes on the -4s? Hearing none, they are adopted. Chair would move passage of House Bill 2803 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion.
Mr. Chair,
Representative McPherson.
I just wanted to note by way of discussion that it is the language that is now in the amended bill requiring that there be appropriate facilities not available inside the state that makes me willing to support this bill in its amended form, and I think that's a critical piece that we got to look first to the facilities that are in state, and on that basis I will support the bill.
Okay, thank you. And call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cuomo?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2803 is amended and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Perfect. Okay, Representative Barker to carry. That concludes the agenda of the committee. We are adjourned.